Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our fantastic study of Daniel 9, 24 to 27, and an examination of the question, when was or will the 70 weeks of Daniel 9, 24 come to an end? As I have shared with you before, this is absolutely a critical issue, because as I've already shared with you in the previous videos, several of them, Daniel 9 foretold, and I don't know of virtually anyone that denies this except those who take the view that Daniel 9 is not a messianic prophecy. It is a prediction instead of the period of time of Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C. Other than that, conservative scholars agree that Daniel chapter 9 is talking about, it's messianic, and it foretold the coming of the kingdom. Now, I will say this, not all that many people see that Daniel chapter 9, 24 to 27 foretold the resurrection. Now, many, many commentators, many scholars take the view that, well, Daniel chapter 9 absolutely does predict Jesus' ministry, and it does predict the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. One thing is certain about it. It does predict the destruction of Jerusalem. And since Daniel, according to the chronology, had lived through the destruction of Jerusalem in B.C. 586 and was predicting a destruction of Jerusalem, well, guess what? That almost demands that he was predicting AD 70. Jerusalem was never destroyed completely, as Daniel 9:26 demands, from the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. until 70 A.D. Now, Jerusalem was surrounded. Jerusalem was even conquered. It was even desolated from time to time. And yes, even under Antiochus Epiphanes, it was desecrated, but it was not completely destroyed, as the text of Daniel chapter 9, verse 26 says. So my point here is that many, many critical commentators, even many conservative commentators, admit and agree, well, Daniel 9 did foretell the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. However, many, many conservative scholars, especially in the postmillennial world and in the amillennial world, they tell us, well, here's the deal. Daniel 9, 24 to 27 predicted the 70 weeks, and the 70 weeks ended, as I have shared with you in several of the videos, in 34 or 35 AD. And that seems to present, they understand, that presents a massive problem. Because Daniel was told 70 weeks are determined on your people and on your holy city. Knowing that the prophecy itself speaks of the people and the city within the confines of the 70 weeks, they've come up with an explanation that says, well, you see, Daniel was not told that the city would be destroyed within the 70 weeks. He was actually being told that the fate of the city would be determined within the 70 weeks, i.e. within Jesus' personal ministry, but that the actual destruction of the city would come after the 70 weeks. Well, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, that simply will not work. Very quickly, point number one, the fate of the city was being determined in Daniel 9. The fate of the city did not have to wait for over 500 years for Jesus to come and say, oh, guess what? Jerusalem and the temple is going to be destroyed. No. The fate of the city and the people was sealed, determined in Daniel 9. And I would also point out, it was determined in Isaiah, that was written over 150 years prior to Daniel. So the suggestion that what Jesus was, or excuse me, that what Daniel was being told was 70 weeks are determined to determine the fate of the people in the city. Well, that's very clearly not what the text says. Furthermore, if you can take the position, all right, if you can take the position that the fate of the people and the city were not to be determined within, take place until after the 70 weeks, then you can as justifiably say, for instance, 70 weeks are determined to finish the transgression. In other words, to fill up the measure of sin. And so, if you're going to say, well, the fate of the city would be determined within the 70 weeks and then fulfilled after the 70 weeks, then why couldn't we not justifiably say, well, the 70 weeks are determined to predict the making of the atonement, the putting away of sin, the finishing of transgression, in other words, the filling up of the measure of sin. 70 weeks are determined to predict the fulfillment of all prophecy. 70 weeks are determined to predict the anointing of the Most High. And 70 weeks are determined to predict or to determine the coming in of everlasting righteousness. But all of those things would actually be fulfilled after the 70 weeks, not within it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that makes no sense whatsoever. And yet, I've had some former full preterists argue that very thing, that the fulfillment of those constituent elements of Daniel chapter 9 did not have to take place within the 70 weeks, but rather Daniel, in predicting them, said that they would happen, and that they would happen, sometime later, sometime after the 70 weeks. Now, oddly enough, in a massive bit of self-contradiction, those same individuals arguing that the constituent elements of Daniel chapter 9 did not have to be fulfilled within the 70 weeks, but could take place after the fulfillment of the 70 weeks, those same individuals turned right around and argued that the 70 weeks were fulfilled in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So on the one hand, they tell us that all of the constituent elements fulfilled within the 70 weeks, and then those same individuals turn right around and tell us, guess what? The constituent elements did not have to be fulfilled within the 70 weeks at all. They may be yet future to us. I'm sorry, folks. That's double talk. That doesn't even make good nonsense. And I'm trying to be kind here, but this sort of utter theological desperation is absolutely amazing. It's untenable, and it's false. But again, we are told that the 70 weeks would end in 34, 35 A.D. But again, that means that you have to be able to say and to be able to prove that all, not some, but all of the constituent elements of Daniel 9 were fulfilled by the time of 34, 35 A.D. Because if the 70 weeks ended in 34, 35 A.D., then the atonement was made by then. We've already demonstrated that the atonement could not be finished until the parousia of Christ. You have to be able to prove that Israel filled up the measure of their sin by 34, 35 A.D., but Jesus put the filling up of the measure of Israel's sin by and through the process of Israel killing Jesus' apostles and prophets. That didn't happen by 34, 35 A.D., and we know that because Paul, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, 15 to 16, said that Israel was, when he wrote, in approximately A.D. 50, at least 15 years beyond 34, 35 A.D., Israel was, at that time, filling up the measure of her sin by killing Jesus' apostles and prophets. So you can't argue that the filling up of the measure of sin was fulfilled at the cross or by 34 or 35 AD, because that violates what Jesus and Paul both said, not to mention the book of Revelation. And you cannot say that the sealing up of vision and prophecy was fulfilled by 34 or 35 AD without demanding that all prophecy was fulfilled by 34 or 35 AD. In my book, Seal, Vision, and Prophecy, I demonstrate by bringing forth a plethora of scholarly quotes from scholars across the entire spectrum of theological belief, it is almost universally admitted. Now, certainly there are some who disagree, the liberal scholars who deny inspiration in the first place, the scholars who believe that Antiochus Epiphanes is the focus of Daniel chapter 9, those folks who take those views, yeah, they deny the application of Daniel chapter 9 as being the time of the fulfillment of all prophecy. But I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, among the scholars who try to say that the 70 weeks were fulfilled by 34, 35 AD, they wind up entrapping themselves in humongous self-contradiction. As an illustration, and by the way, I document that in my book, 70 weeks are determined for the resurrection, as well as in my book, the resurrection of Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, fulfilled or future, and my book, Seal Up Vision and Prophecy. I'm not going to take the time, you know, to go into great detail documenting what I'm sharing with you right now. All of this is fully documented in each of those books. Here's what I mean. Kenneth Gentry, who I have challenged to debate me, others have challenged to debate me formally, but who adamantly refuses, he's always too busy. Oddly enough, he's very often found time to write very lengthy, in-depth articles attempting to refute what I say, but he just doesn't have time to debate me publicly. You know, YouTube, Zoom, whatever, just doesn't have the time. Nonetheless, Kenneth Gentry says that seal up vision and prophecy, now this is early on in his attacks against covenant eschatology, but in a moment of a momentary lapse of logical acumen, says it's very possible that that terminology of seal, vision, and prophecy had to do with the completion of the revelatory process. Well, when some preterists pointed out, if that's true, if seal up vision and prophecy meant the completion of the revelatory process, meaning that all New Testament books were written by 34 or 35 AD, guess what? Then all of the books of the New Testament were written by 34 or 35 AD. Well, Mr. Gentry soon came to realize he had taken an untenable position. So he completely abandoned that position and is now in kind of a no man's land in regard to what he really feels is the true meaning of seal, vision, and prophecy. You see the problems that are created here? If you try to say that the 70 weeks are determined to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to seal vision and prophecy. You see the problems that it creates? And oh, by the way, finally, and for time's sake, I've got to hurry here. If you're going to say that the 70 weeks were determined, were fulfilled by 34, 35 AD, then you've got to say, that 2 Peter chapter 3 and Revelation 21, in their predictions of the new heaven and the new earth wherein dwells righteousness, was completely fulfilled by 34, 35 AD. Well, wait a minute. That won't work because the everlasting world of righteousness, the new heaven and new earth of 2 Peter chapter 3 is at the so-called end of time when Mr. Gentry says it's yet future. But wait a minute. If 2 Peter chapter 3 and its prediction of the coming in of the new heaven and the new earth of everlasting righteousness, if that's the same world of everlasting righteousness of Daniel chapter 9, then you cannot say the 70 weeks were fulfilled in AD 34 or 35, because Peter's still looking for the fulfillment of it in 2 Peter 3, as was John in Revelation 21. Of course, John said it was about to take place. It was coming soon, quickly, and shortly. So once again, Mr. Gentry completely, totally entraps himself by saying the 70 weeks ended in 34 or 35 A.D. By the way, Gary DeMar has taken that same view, that the 70 weeks ended in 34 or 35 A.D. Joel McDermott took that position. I don't know what he believes about it now. And so you see, ladies and gentlemen, what I've been sharing with you in this series of in this series of videos is that it is simply untenable. If we take Daniel chapter 9 as a messianic prophecy, you cannot say that the 70 weeks were ended at the cross. I had a formal written debate with a professor by the name of Sergius Bale, on the dating of the book of Revelation. As a preliminary, I asked him, when was or when will the 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9 completely fulfilled? He wrote, you know, a dissertation that long, and he said the 70 weeks were fulfilled by the cross. Well, I've already gone over the reasons why that simply cannot be true. It simply is not true. And so, if you take the view that Daniel chapter 9 is messianic, you cannot say that Daniel 9 was fulfilled at the cross, and you cannot say it was fulfilled in 34 or 35 A.D. The New Testament writers, writing after the cross, after 34, 35, we're still anticipating the fulfillment of Daniel 9. But then you see, we come to the other view that I have mentioned several times, and that is the view that is taken, generally speaking, there are exceptions, by what we generally refer to as the liberal critical scholars, who do not believe in the inspiration of Scripture. Now, listen to me. You got to catch the power of this. Once again, there are exceptions to this, okay? I have conversed with men, corresponded with men who take the Antiochus Epiphanes view, but who still believe in the reality of the inspiration of Scripture. However, let me, make no mistake here. The great bulk of those who deny that Daniel 9 is messianic, number one, do not believe in inspiration. Okay? They do not believe in plenary verbal inspiration. They believe that Daniel was a fictitious author, that someone who wanted to write a book and give it a whole lot of credence and, validity, took Daniel's name. Daniel was a man known in the Jewish communities, but he was long dead, long, long dead. But this individual in the second century, whoever it might have been, decided to write this book that we call Daniel. And he used the name of Daniel. Now, let me make this observation very, very quickly. In Ezekiel chapter 14 and 14, Ezekiel is generally considered to be roughly parallel, roughly contemporary, a little bit of disparity, but nonetheless, in Ezekiel chapter 14 and 14, Ezekiel mentions the righteous Daniel. The righteous Daniel. Well, I wonder if that fits the man of Daniel or the book of Daniel. Well, of course it does. So those who reject the Danielic authorship of the book of Daniel say, well, you see, yeah, that's a different Daniel. Because the Daniel who wrote the book of Daniel lived in the 2nd century B.C., but Ezekiel, written in the 6th century B.C., was a real guy, but they're not the same. Now, what evidence do they adduce for that? Oh, none. They're just simply relying on their presuppositional denial of inspiration. But if we believe and if we accept that Ezekiel knew of, maybe even knew, Daniel the prophet, then that means that the book of Daniel was written prior to Antiochus Epiphanes. But to continue, we are told, number one, there's no such thing as inspiration. Number two, there was no such thing as genuine, true prophecy. In other words, all of these Bible, quote, prophecies, unquote, were written after the fact by fictitious authors who wanted to give Israel in times of difficulty comfort. And so they did so by writing a fictitious work, putting the name of a well-known, well-respected, quote, prophet, unquote, onto the book and writing it as if it was a prophecy. How convenient, right? In the aforementioned debate with Professor Sergius Bale, as I sought to demonstrate the early date of Revelation, Professor Bale said, well, you have to consider the fact that it's very possible that John the Apostle didn't even write the book, that he used an amanuensis secretary. Well, I mean, certainly possible that John dictated to a secretary the contents of the Apocalypse, but that doesn't mean that he was not the source of it. But Professor Bale went on to say, scholarship really debates whether or not it was written by John, and it could have been written much later than John. Well, when I pointed out that 1 Peter was written prior to AD 70, once again, Mr. Bale jumped up and he said, well, that is a hotly debated subject among scholars, and Preston's view on this may well be considered heretical. Seriously? Because I would take an early date of Peter, I could be considered a heretic? But you see, here's the bottom line. Here's Mr. Bale, who has been drinking at the fountain of liberal scholarship that rejects legitimate inspiration. Now, I've never been able to pin Mr. Bale down for him to tell us, yes or no, if 1 Peter and if Revelation are genuinely inspired by God or not. He will not answer. As of the time that I make this video today, I have asked him repeatedly to answer that question. He totally refuses. And he says, our debate is not about whether or not these books were inspired. Well, yes, it is. Because 1 Peter says it was written by Peter. So it's either written by Peter or the dude lied, whoever wrote it. John said he wrote Revelation. He got the vision of the Revelation. So John either lied or he had a secretary do it, which in case he still dictated it. And thus, he's still the author. So this is what we deal with when we're dealing with people who have imbibed and drank at the fountain of, quote, higher critical scholarship. Now look, I am absolutely not depreciating the value of scholarship. I'm sitting in an office. Every wall is full of very, very scholarly material. I've got a room there with bookshelves full of scholarly books. I've got a room right here full of books of scholarly nature. But you see, when I start reading these books and they tell me, well, Daniel 9 was not messianic. Daniel 9 is not inspired prophecy. Daniel 9 was not written by Daniel. You see, there is sufficient evidence to demonstrate the fallacy of their positions. One of those scholarly books on the bookshelf right over there is by John Collins, one of the most noted scholars in the world of Danielic authorship, or the book of Daniel. He denies the inspiration of Daniel 9. He denies the Danielic authorship of Daniel 9. He denies that it was a messianic prophecy. So here we are, 25 minutes into this video, and I want to share with you, I want to address the question, was Daniel chapter 9 a prophecy of the time, or was it a retro look, what the scholars called an ex eventu writing, a retrospective look at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and his pogroms against Israel, his attempt to convert all of Israel to the Grecian way of life, his attacks on the priesthood of Israel, the city and the temple of Israel. Not written by, you know, the prophet Daniel, and clearly not an inspired prophecy. In order to address this question, let's just look again at the work that was to be accomplished according to Daniel chapter 9, 24, within the 70 weeks. You know, I'm not going to examine the mathematical attempts by the quote, liberal scholars, unquote, to make the time frame of the 70 weeks fit the period of Antiochus Epiphanes. I'm just simply going to look at the constituent elements that are found in Daniel chapter 9 and to see if they fit historically or theologically to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So, Daniel chapter 9, 70 weeks are determined to put away sin. Now, here's one thing about it, ladies and gentlemen. This is amazing. In Daniel chapter 8, 23 through following, Daniel foretold the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the judgment that was coming on Israel. Why? Because at that period of time, Israel would fill up the measure of her sin. And you may be going, oh, wait, guess what? That fits Daniel chapter 9. Well, it does in one way, only anachronistically, as we will see. We have to understand, look, the 10 tribes of Israel filled up the measure of their sin and were carried captive, 721. The Jews of the 6th century B.C. filled up the measure of their sin and were destroyed by the Babylonians in 586. And in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, Israel filled up the measure of her sin and was judged. Oh, and by the way, you could even argue that in the period of time of the judges, during the period of time of the judges, one generation after another of the Jews, of Israel, filled up the measure of their sin, and God would bring the Midianites. He would bring, whoever, Amalekites, whoever, to judge them, to destroy them. They were filling up the measure of their sin in those generations. But you see, there was to be an ultimate filling up of the measure of sin. And when that sin was judged, the kingdom, the everlasting righteousness would come. More on that here momentarily. Okay, so we are told that 70 weeks are determined to put away sin. Well, obviously, if Israel was filling up the measure of their sin in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, which brought about their judgment at the hands of Antiochus Epiphanes, then sin wasn't put away, was it? It had filled up. And someone might rejoin by saying, well, the putting away of sin is when in the time of Mattathias and the Maccabees, they managed to defeat the forces of Antiochus Epiphanes after he was dead. But they reconquered Jerusalem, they recaptured the temple, they purified the temple, and they began offering sacrifices on it again. I'm sorry, this is not going to work, as we shall see momentarily. Because you see, even though the recapture of Jerusalem was a marvelous event in Jewish history, even though the rededication of the temple was marvelous, here's something you have to understand. Judas Maccabeus, if I got that particular point correct, they took the vessels of the temple and they hid them, according to their own words, until such a time as a true prophet would arise in Israel that would allow the temple to be properly cleansed, properly rededicated, and properly functioning again. The Maccabeans knew that what they were doing was not the full restoration of the temple cultus. Therefore, the 70 weeks in regard to 70 weeks are determined to put away sin was not fulfilled in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes or even after his death in the time of John Hacranus, Judas Maccabeus, and the Maccabean warriors. And by the way, this raises an interesting question. How could these warrior sons of Mattathias, how could these warrior sons be high priests? How could they offer acceptable sacrifice when, according to Jewish law and according to Jewish tradition, no man who had fought in war, who had shed blood, could be a high priest? That means that none of them, John Hyrcanus, Judas Maccabeus, Simeon, none of the sons of Mattathias could serve as high priest. Why? Because they had all shed blood. Therefore, they could not offer sacrifices to put away sin. They were disqualified. To continue, 70 weeks are determined to make the atonement. Now, let me jump forward because this aspect of Daniel chapter 9, 24 must be placed within the context of 70 weeks are determined to anoint the most holy. Now, there is, as I shared in an earlier video, there's a great deal of controversy. Are we talking about to anoint the most holy place? Now, remember, if 70 weeks are determined to anoint the most holy place, if that refers to the time of John Hyrcanus, Judas Maccabeus, etc., none of them could consecrate, none of them could anoint the most holy place because they were men of war. They were not qualified high priests. I'm sorry, this does not work. If Jewish law forbade men of war, men who shed blood, doesn't matter if it's guilty blood or not, if they were disqualified from being high priest, and only a high priest, purified high priest, qualified high priest, would ever be able to offer an anointing sacrifice and a cleansing sacrifice of the most holy place. But again, none of the Maccabeans were justly purified or qualified because they were men of war. Will others say that the terminology to anoint the most holy is therefore to anoint the most holy one? And therefore he would make the atonement? Well, point number one, go back to what I just said. Okay? You cannot anoint any of the Maccabees as high priest. Sorry, they're disqualified. Secondly, here's what you need to know, and you absolutely must catch the power of this. The very last of the duly qualified, genealogically confirmed Zadokite / Levitical priest who were purified enough to serve as high priest was Onias III. Now, there's some controversy about exactly when he was killed. Some believe he was killed 167 B.C. after the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. Others believe that Antiochus Epiphanes approved of his killing. But here's the point, okay? Here's what you got to catch. Here is what is absolutely irrefutable. Onias III was the very last of the duly qualified Zadokite / Levitical priest who was purified sufficiently to serve as the most holy, most holy one. Why? You know why? And listen, this is recognized by all scholars on the Jewish priesthood. I don't know of any of them that disagree with this. Onias III was killed by the henchmen of Antiochus Epiphanes, by Jacob, who was a brother of Onias, and Menelaus. Now, Menelaus and Jacob conspired with Aristobulus, again, one of the leaders under Antiochus Epiphanes. And with approval, they killed Onias. Now, guess what that means? Both of those men, even though they are of the Zadokite lineage, even though they are of the Levitical lineage, they are thereby totally disqualified from being a high priest. And yet, do you see a train coming? When they killed Onias III, guess what? I said Jacob, it was Jason. Jason became high priest. He was very promptly deposed. And Menelaus became high priest. But both men were murderers. So, 70 weeks are determined to anoint the most holy. If we take the position that it's the most holy place, I'm sorry, that doesn't work because none of the Maccabees were qualified to anoint the most holy place in the temple. Number two, if you take the position that to anoint the most holy one is the proper view, then Onias III was the very last of the high priest. And by the way, he was already anointed. He was already anointed when Antiochus Epiphanes came to power. He was deposed through murder. And his, quote, successors were both murderers who could not be the most holy one to be anointed. And here's what is universally accepted. From the time of Onias III until the time of Jesus, there was not a single properly qualified, genealogically confirmed, morally pure high priest to hold the office of high priest. Folks, you catch the power of that? Not one. And by the way, this is part of the reason why the Dead Sea community came into existence. Because the Essenes out there at Qumran knew and understood that the priesthood of Jerusalem was corrupt, had been corrupt for centuries. There were no qualified priests serving as high priest from the time of Onias until the time of Jesus. So once again, that's why the Essenes went out to Qumran and established their community and looked forward to coming, to the coming of the righteous teacher and the coming of the true high priest, who would be a pure high priest to restore the sanctity of the temple and the sacrifices. They knew the priesthood was corrupt. So ladies and gentlemen, when someone says, when the liberal scholars say, oh, 70 weeks are determined to anoint the Most Holy One, I'm sorry. The Most Holy One was killed, murdered by Jason and Menelaus, which disqualified them from ever being high priest. And from that point forward, the high priesthood, the office of high priest, was sold to the highest bidder, which means they were corrupt, they were dishonest, they were frauds, they were fakes, they were disqualified. That means that any possibility of 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9 applying to the anointing of the Most Holy One cannot be true. But I must hurry. Finally, 70 weeks are determined to bring in everlasting righteousness. Now, very quickly, let me point out, 70 weeks are determined to seal vision and prophecy. Those who take the Antiochus Epiphanes view, they generally take a attack something like this. They say, well, to seal up vision and prophecy, that means to seal up the vision and the prophecy of Jeremiah, chapter 29, for the time of the release from the Babylonian captivity. Well, number one, that doesn't bring us to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So that countdown is wrong. Secondly, they are inserting a definite article into the text that is not present in the Masoretic text or the Septuagint. They're literally adding words to the text. That means their view is wrong. Daniel 9 is not talking about the fulfillment of a specific prophecy. It is talking about vision and prophecy comprehensively concerned. Now look, I demonstrate this by the citation of one scholar after another, again, from wide range of scholarship, in my book, Seal It, Vision and Prophecy. There is literally no justification for saying 70 weeks are determined to fill up the, or to seal the vision of Daniel, or the vision of Jeremiah. I'm sorry, it doesn't work. It is not a singular vision and prophecy in view. But I must move on. 70 weeks are determined to bring in everlasting righteousness. Now look, folks, if you don't get anything else out of this, you absolutely must catch the power of this. If you're going to take the view that Daniel 9 is talking about the coming of Antiochus Epiphanes and the change of the priesthood, you've got to be able to demonstrate how everlasting righteousness was established in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Instead, you have a time of the persecution of the Jews. Now, obviously, it can be argued that with Mattathias and his sons, the time of the Maccabees, that was a time of an effort to restore true worship, but again, they were murderers. They were killers. They were men of war. Secondly, as we've already seen, guess what? The priesthood was destroyed. In the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, there was not another qualified high priest from the time of Antiochus Epiphanes to the time of Jesus. Therefore, no righteousness. In my disputes with former preterist Sam Frost, who denied, who knows what he believes now, he's constantly changing his position. But at the time, he and I were going back and forth on Daniel chapter 9, and he was denying the messianic prophecy aspect of Daniel 9. I kept asking him, along with a lady from Australia named Julianne Chambers, she's an excellent student, we kept asking him, what everlasting righteousness was established in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes? What everlasting righteousness was established with the murder of Onias III? What everlasting righteousness was established since the temple could not be properly purified since there was no qualified high priest? Where was the everlasting kingdom, which is what Daniel 9 is all about, where was that established? Now look, we got lots of smoke. We got lots of dust. We got lots of blow and bluster and thunder. And we got no answer. Period. Ladies and gentlemen, the fact that Daniel chapter 9 said 70 weeks are determined to bring in everlasting righteousness, and the undeniable historical and theological reality that everlasting righteousness was not established in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes or in the time of the Maccabees, as noble as their aims were. The fact that everlasting righteousness in the kingdom was not established in their day or by their efforts completely falsifies the view that Daniel 9 was a prophecy ex eventu, after the fact, writing concerning the period of Antiochus Epiphanes. And finally, and again I have to hurry here, Daniel 9 foretold the time of the abomination of desolation, which of course means it was talking about the time of the Great Tribulation. And that abomination of desolation is posited squarely and firmly at the time of the destruction of the city and the temple. Now here's something you need to know. This is critical. Once again, you have to catch the power of this. Those scholars, such as John Collins, that I have already referred to, they want to say Daniel 9 is all about the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, his attacks on Jerusalem, his setting up of an altar and offering a pig on the altar, renaming the temple Zeus after the pagan gods. Oh, that is the fulfillment of Daniel chapter 9. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, that does not work. So here's John Collins saying, you know, the abomination of desolation, that is that pig being altered or offered on the temple by the general of Antiochus Epiphanes. Sorry. 70 weeks are determined, we are told, for the city and the people. And after the 62 and 9 weeks, now watch this, the city and the sanctuary shall be destroyed. And here's an undeniable reality. Even though the book of Maccabees talks about the temple being desecrated, even though the book of Maccabees talks about the abomination of desolation being set up, Guess what? The temple nor the city were destroyed in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Desecrated? Absolutely. Defiled? Undeniably. Destroyed? Absolutely not. Now, since Daniel chapter 9 undeniably, graphically, definitively predicted the destruction, not simply the desecration, not simply the defilement, but the destruction of the city and the temple. And since the city and the temple were not destroyed in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, that means that Daniel chapter 9 did not predict or even talk about the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And finally and definitively, the fact that Jesus, in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15, when Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, let the one who reads understand, then let those who are in Judea flee. Well, let me tell you something. By the time that Antiochus had the pig offered on the temple altar, or the altar that he erected, the Jews, the faithful Jews, had already fled. They'd already fled long before that. Nonetheless, here is Jesus in Matthew chapter 24 anticipating the setting up of the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. Now, men such as Sam Frost, men such as John Collins even, and other writers and commentators, for instance, Kyle Pope, that I somewhat recently reviewed his book, Thinking About AD 70, I did 20 videos examining his book. But in his book, he said Jesus was not saying that Daniel foretold the coming of the abomination of desolation. What Jesus was really saying, and again, this is the view of liberal scholars, it's the view of Sam Frost, former preterist. What Jesus was saying is, now I want you to remember this, Antiochus Epiphanes set up the abomination of desolation. And when you see something that reminds you of that, then get out of town. But you see, unfortunately for that position, that is not what Jesus said. When you see what was spoken of by Daniel, the abomination of desolation, then understand and flee. He did not say, when you see something like what Daniel predicted that happened in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, he said, when you see what Daniel spoke about. What did Daniel speak about? The abomination of desolation. Oh, and in Daniel 12:1, Daniel spoke of the great tribulation, which Jesus said would follow the abomination of desolation in his generation. So what does that mean? Since Jesus unequivocally applied the prophecy of Daniel 9 and Daniel 12 to his generation and the events of his generation, that means Daniel 9 was a messianic prophecy. Now look, there's a great deal more that I could say on this event or on this issue, but I'm out of time. And this will conclude our study of the question, when did or will the prophecy of Daniel 9, 24 and following, come to an end? I will have one more video in which I will summarize those things which we have examined in this series of videos. I want to thank you for tuning in. I want to thank you for purchasing these videos. I believe, and I hope and I pray, they've been a tremendous blessing for you in understanding better the magnificent, marvelous, and inspired word of our God. Thanks again.